This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it, all while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Pierre Lanza. Why is the internet making us so unhappy? Why, for that matter, is it in capital's interest to cultivate populations that are depressed and desperate rather than driven by the same irrational exuberance that moves money? Sadness is now a design problem. The highs and lows of melancholy are coded into social media platforms. After all the clicking, browsing, swiping and liking, all we are left with is the flat and empty aftermath of time lost to the app. Side by Design by Hert Loving offers a critical analysis of the controversies which drive online media behaviors. Loving calls for us to embrace the engineered intimacy of social media, messenger apps and selfies, because boredom is the first stage of overcoming platform nihilism. Hert Loving is a media theorist and internet critic who has chronicled the development of internet and network cultures as they came of age alongside him. He is the author of Zero Comments, Network Without a Cause, Social Media Abyss, and most recently, Stuck on the Platform. He is the founder of the Institute of Network Cultures in Amsterdam, where we met.
Gert, welcome to the show.
Pleased to meet you. My name is Gert Loving, and we're here in Amsterdam inside my office at the Institute of Network Cultures.
Thank you for welcoming me here. We are talking at the fringes of a conference and a book launch in which I have the luck to participate tomorrow, talking about memes. But that's not what we're going to be doing today. Today, we're going to be dealing with something much more rounded. We're going to be talking about being sad on the internet. Let's start with something even bigger. How does one study the internet? How have you studied the internet? As you said, we're at an Institute of Network Cultures, which is one of, I think, very, very few such institutions in the world. And you lament in the book the lack of study, studies performed formally within academia on the internet. So it'd be good maybe for our listeners to understand a little bit how you've come where you are and how you have evolved in your research along with the beast.
Yeah, my approach is maybe what you could call, you know, a critical ethnographic approach, which means that I do not mind to see myself and the work that we do as people who are on the fringes and on the front lines and document and try to reflect, try to summarize, try to conceptualize with the aim to bring the field further and go in two directions. Very simple. The one direction is to critique, to understand, to analyze, and you know, to really get a deep understanding. The other direction is, of course, with that knowledge, to change the course of things, which means that we develop alternative interfaces, communities. Communities of practice, research networks, primarily working with programmers, designers, artists, activists, and other irregulars.
That's quite a lot. We might be able to test some of these claims, given that we're talking about one of your many books that deal with the evolution of the internet. You were just telling me earlier, Side by Design is number 6 in the whole story. I wonder whether I could ask you to kind of give a little bit of a evolutionary history, where you started and how maybe the terms have been evolving. And I wanted to ask you that so that maybe, given that we're talking a couple of years after the book was released, that we can kind of go back and see whether you were right, but also maybe what we can learn from whether you were right or not.
Let me start in the historical year, yeah. 2016, because this is a very important year. It's the year of, you know, the election of Trump and
that's Brexit. That's the year we will never leave.
No, absolutely.
That's the real end of history
for
us.
Very often we thought, you know, it was going to be 2008 or something like that. But I think in retrospect, 2016 is even more pivotal year. Of course, for those in the Ukraine, it must have been, you know, 2014, a little bit earlier. So there are a few things that of course, lead up to this year. It's also the year my previous book, Social Media Abyss, came out. And, mm-hmm. and I started on this one, right? I see myself as somebody who writes a chronicle of internet culture. Of course, mm-hmm. you know, maybe I'm not the only one. However, you know, I've been around for 30 years. So in that sense, I've been doing this for quite a while. And I have lived through all the stages. The first time I encountered the internet, I was 30, you know, so I was already in 1989. I was, of course, I was a long-term unemployed media theorist. that's my Werdegang. That's my,
There was a future for us all.
Yeah, exactly. But not for me.
That's the next book.
And precisely at that moment of ultimate despair after, a good 6 years of unemployment. I encountered the internet and the whole story around virtual reality and cyberspace and cyberpunk and a lot of things from the late 80s that were not just only rumors or nice sci-fi stories, but started to materialize. And that's when I started. We're now, in 2016, because that's the starting point of this book. Mm-hmm. It's a year in which things really, really started to shift. This is the big enclosure. Or there are many names for it, right? Some people talk about the Great Regression. Others, emphasize at that very moment in time the kind of the extractivist techniques of Silicon Valley were at their height. It's also the year of Cambridge Analytica, of course. So it's the year in which this kind of very subtle, behind our back manipulation was at its height. And the conceptual understanding of it, what was going on at that very moment, was very poor. Right. Mm-hmm. So we came kind of from Web 2.0, and we came from an idea that the users were involved and that there was this kind of participatory element there, and that this was the driver. This was the early age of online video, of blogs. And that age, that era, we already felt, was kind of coming to a close. Of course, the years before that, it was, the financial meltdown in 2008, and quite a long period of a somewhat mild recession was happening. So the stagnation was kind of already there. But in 2016, I feel from there on, it really started to manifest itself, its might, its power. And this is what I describe in this book, all centered around this and the central notion of the platform as a new form of enclosure, started to really manifest itself. And for a lot of users, this for the first time became apparent. So no more empowerment, but enclosures.
I'm going to attempt a lame joke. A few days ago, I posted some pithy thing on Facebook about advertising algorithms. Clearly, I wasn't funny enough because one of the responses I got, oh, you just use an ad blocker. So someone earnestly was trying to give me advice. And then my response was, but look, if you don't watch adverts, how do you know that you're unhappy? So I'm going to ask you, how do we know that we're unhappy online and why are we unhappy online?
First of all, I think there is an objective tendency towards that. We can talk about subjective moods or mental states of mind. And as we know, there are quite a few of those possible responses or affects that we can express. Now, the question, of course, that people after this book came out and you know, became quite successful, it was translated in six languages and so on. So I had to very often confront myself with this question, why in particular sadness? And I think this is a fair enough question, you know, because there is that full range, right? And people do make a distinction, for instance, between male anger and female sadness, and that is an interesting division we can make. However, I think that the fact that people feel that they're really entrapped, that they really can't go somewhere else, right? In the classic capitalist idea of the consumer choice. If you don't like this, you just go somewhere. If you don't like sadness, you know, you just do something else.
You pay an extra $3 and suddenly happiness is available as we will.
Right?
It's $8 for happiness now as we well know.
So, but unfortunately, it wasn't quite like that. Mm. So these enclosures, the dependency, the idea that all your friends and family and business opportunities, work-related stuff is all there, and you can't just walk away from it. You can't just say, oh, well, you know, I don't care. Even if you don't care anymore about your friends or family, you know, society will, you know, ask you to log in through Facebook or Google and so on, right? Yeah. So there are all sorts of even formal necessities that will keep you there. And the sadness comes up at the moment when you feel there's nowhere else to go.
Is there nowhere else to go?
No, of course not. And, you know, I'm coming from the squatter movement. I'm coming from the social movements. And we wanted to believe that there are subcultures, that there is an underground, that there is a dark web, that there is alternative possibilities that we develop. Open source software and free software in order to make a difference, right? So this is where I come from. This is what I've been doing for 30, 40 years, right? So I have to answer your question in a very honest way. We believed that there was another internet possible. And along the way, we had to find out that this message, these apps and whatever we developed were completely incapable of competing with the might of the platform.
I mean, without getting distracted by details, of course, we're witnessing this a little bit. We're recording this conversation maybe a few days after Elon Musk has taken over Twitter. And of course, anyone who has given any time to Twitter will have already been invited to join Mastodon or however one is pronouncing this. And my first guess, it will go exactly the way you describe. But I want us to get back to this because the questions of subcultures and alternatives is clearly something that preoccupies you. But now I want to ask a slightly more kind of capital and more ideological question. Why is capitalism happy for us to be sad? Why this particular mode of exploitation has become so dominant, particularly in the period that you are writing about in this book? And I think the second question then is, how does that start changing in online cultures over the pandemic, where this kind of feeling, the feeling of stuckness and feeling not being able to go anywhere is actually motivated by something very different? So you know, why does Klaus Schwab at World Economic Forum want us to be unhappy?
Yeah, it's definitely counterintuitive, and it's for a long time it wasn't really where I wanted to go, and also it wasn't really something that I had always aspired to study, or let alone promote in the sense, I'm myself not a melancholic person.
You're perfectly well adjusted to all of this.
So it is really the young people, the student, my own son, who is now 20. So there's a whole new generation, particularly the Gen Z ones. Yeah. So they kind of embodied it, they incorporated it, and they cultivated it. And Klaus Schwab hasn't done that for us. I think they came into this quite late, to be honest, because in the official, let's say, business management marketing literature, this was not really planned.
Yeah.
And there are still no books about this, right? So it is not an official religion. Even Google and Facebook will continue to deny that all this is going on. The only thing is what they say is, you've been on the internet too long and we'll give you some apps to reduce your screen time. Yeah. Right, so this has been their only response so far.
We have this paradox when we have this kind of wellness industry, which is of course app-based, but at the same time we have whistleblowers like Francis Hagen saying we are manipulating
exactly.
you until you're exhausted.
I'm quoting them, and
yeah.
they are really and those sources, even up to now, and we are now, let's say, a good 5 years later. Those sources, they're very rare. We know that there are everywhere in the industry behavioral psychologists working that kind of tweak the systems, and that for instance the way YouTube works, where it offers you videos that are in fact worse, these are conscious design and algorithmic decisions. This has been programmed, it's not accidental. Right, you could say, okay, the AI just learns and figures out that more and more people will go in that direction. No, I mean that's it doesn't work like that. We know that, right? So a lot of this has been done in the laboratories through trial and error, and not so much through learning algorithms or an AI that is superior to us all.
But I think even within that, we need to be a little bit more granular, because what you just invoked is this kind of funnel where we start watching, influencer videos about cat food, and we end up with school shootings, this kind of trajectory of the YouTube algorithm. But at the same time, there is a maybe more female than male trajectory, maybe slightly younger, in which one just gets into this kind of endless TikTok loop, which is, of course, something that capitalism really wants. I mean, Chinese developers are much better than manipulating people, and we know this from the human rights record. They know how to do this even well. And there is indeed a good amount of study on those effects. I'm thinking in particular of Jonathan Haidt, for instance, who's written about the psychology of a Facebook addict, the fact that a 14-year-old girl is essentially lost. But you do go in the book into this kind of various types of sadness, melancholia and hatred. You have one of these beautiful, I don't think this is you, but you attribute to something to Andrew Kolb. You say that we overcome sadness not through happiness, but through a hatred of this world. So I'm interested in how you see these different types of emotional responses and how they correspond to different network architectures and different algorithmic architectures. And I may be using this as an invitation to get you to talk about the differences between networks and platforms and so on. So it's some of this kind of technical aspect that might help us to think about this effect.
The industry we're talking about here is primarily driven by advertisement, and driven by the planned desire to keep you there, because what is really the most precious commodity out there is time. So the attention economy is very foundational in this respect. we need to stay there. We need to spend more time, and all this time is meticulously measured, and will be further studied and monetized at some point. Right. And I think this is a fundamentally different architecture from what earlier on we maybe from the first or second generation of the internet thought or was going to be, the network approach, in which things are much more loose, things are much more fluid. And for instance, it is much easier to jump from one network to another for a network to grow, and of course there are phases, and we know that from the dynamics of virtual communities, that also communities themselves can get stuck. The difference there is that this is a community of a few hundred people. not 3.5 billion. And so the difference here is really one of scale. And the scale of all this is kind of unprecedented, and we kind of got used to it. But we need to remind ourselves really time and again, to this very question. Why is Twitter that is considered really a kind of a small entity, has 650 million people on it? I mean, that's beyond imagination of have you any idea how we should deal with that? These are entities that we can no longer really comprehend. And of course, you could say, okay, well, it's a platform, and inside that platform there are networks and networks of networks and so on. You could break it down. And of course, you could say, okay, they're distinct because the people speak different languages, they're on different parts of the world, in different cultures, and so on. Yeah, we can try to...
Definitely, you don't even follow me on Twitter, so we're definitely very separate.
Yeah, no, exactly, right? So the sheer size of it, economies of scale, that's what defines our age. And, if we say, okay, we have some kind of longing or nostalgia for decentralized local networks, well, there's a good reason for that. I'm not saying, this is justified or that we should, and that there is a path back, for humankind to start with. Is there, is there a way out of this where, we're at the point of where the internet now, this year, has reached the 5 billion mark of the amount of users? I cannot really can get over how we need to think this.
One of the things that I wanted to, when I was trying to think of slightly provocative questions or whether to push back a little bit, I wondered whether there isn't in our, not just yours, but in our collective, intellectualized or sometimes academic understanding of the internet, the same kind of metropolitan liberal tendency as we have in a lot of other research and cultural theory. And I was trying to figure out whether, in fact, a lot of the phenomena that we notice on Twitter or notice on Facebook or statements that we make about these platforms don't actually apply in a very particular way to us as heavy users, people who are online in inverted commas. And whether, in fact, there isn't a whole subsection of the kind of forgotten, rural, post-industrial town. What about people who didn't go to university? What did they talk about on Twitter? And I was actually finding, in response to that, I realized that you do address a bit of this in the book by talking about how underdeveloped internet studies are as a discipline. So it's kind of not really surprising that when academics, even though you have just earlier before I press record, you told me that you're not an academic, that we're not in a university, it's kind of not surprising that we are fascinated with our own culture, but it's essentially a liberal culture talking about liberal culture. So I want to ask you whether you do have an inkling, like how does the Indian subcontinent represent itself on social media? How do we account for a village in southern England to whose private Facebook group I infiltrated recently. How do we account for the fact that they are complaining about the graffiti that's just turned up on the underpass? And that's all. Oh, well, they've uncovered a paedophile, so I guess there's something in common with the rest of the network there. Are those platforms, those parts of the platforms, prone to exactly the same kind of affect economies that you describe in a book? Because, of course, they're equally well exploited algorithmically. That's, you know, these are the big numbers on which the platform relies. They don't particularly care whether they're talking to people who know what they're doing or not.
I am the first to admit that, you know, these are Western concerns. And I do write about the fact that these platforms, for a lot of people in the Global South, are absolutely necessary communication tools to keep up to date and to be in contact while, you know, they have to travel for hours and commute really long distances when parts of their family or tribes are in completely different parts of the world, where, you know, there's still a huge gap between half of humankind that now lives in urban circumstances and the other half, you know, in which they're still in contact with. So, you know, we're still half of humankind is still rural. And of course, now, you know, just recently, it tipped, and it's a bit over 50%. So all these reasons indicate that, you know, the technology, especially through mobile and smartphones, are absolutely vital to survive for the vast majority of people on this planet. And that what we are talking about here is some kind of luxury, and it kind of explains also what we try to do here. We try to explain why these platforms became so big, or how their extractivist logics work, how surveillance works, and all these kind of things. But for ordinary users, you know, it's not like they ignore this, or they have a very good sense of this. Mm-hmm. But their urgencies and you know, daily struggles and will to survive is a very different one.
So I guess we arrive at a question of responsibility, and, you know, like, in as much as we acknowledge that nobody knew what was going to happen at the recent, you know, watershed 2016-8, and, you know, when the first version of Facebook appeared, we didn't know what would happen. But now we do, because there's still another half of the world's population that's only getting into the technologies that we already took for granted 5-10 years ago. But this is something that you illuminated in the book for me in an interesting way. You track the trajectory from media to networks to platforms. And the thing that really arrested me all of this is the story you bring up of IBM, International Business Machines, being already involved in the Holocaust. There's no nice way of saying that. Everyone knows the story that Fanta was invented by the Nazis, but that it strikes me that the IBM story is way more important. And in fact, damn it, we already knew everything. How is it that we still pretend that we don't know? What is missing in the ethnography? What is missing in the theorization?
Mm. I'm using in this particular chapter a lot of the insights, let's say, from Italian and German autonomous movements and thinkers from the 1970s. And their central claim, it's kind of late, let's say, class struggle theory, yeah. Right? So it comes from really the 1968 movements and then runs into the very dark 1970s, mm-hmm. when things really get stuck in their own ways. But one central term that I find really, really fascinating is this idea of the technologischer Angriff, the technological attack that is there, and that this is targeted against the kind of vital forms in which workers, communities, whoever, organize themselves. And the technological attack consists really of these stages that, you know, I describe there. And IBM is a perfect example for that going from the census very early on, right? In the late 19th century, IBM machines were developed for the first American census, which means tracking of the population, counting them, right? Quantified approach. And then what we see is that this technology then, in the setting of the late 1930s, gets instrumentalized to not just count and, let's say, create an overview of the whole population, but to target very specific groups, to identify them, and then to exterminate them, right? So it's the counting, the identification, and then the extermination. And it is this a kind of logic that we see happening time and again, especially in times of crisis. And that's what we forget because, you know, it's not always crisis, right? There's not always war in Ukraine, right? No, but it's happening right now.
Yeah.
And that's what happens. And in such a moment, these mechanisms start to become apparent again and start to perform, if you like.
It's kind of paradoxical because Ukraine, as far as I've been able to ascertain, is actually one of the European states that's more avowed of like citizen-facing technology than any others. Now, Ukrainians, you know, register their cars and claim the pension through an app on the phone, and they have done so for a long time, long before even the European Union states.
The Germans.
It's incredibly strange that this is where we've got. You mentioned the role of class thinking, class struggle, and class theorization. And I wanted to use that to go back to something you mentioned in passing in the book, which is the kind of Althusserian model of the creation of ideologies. Ideologies kind of traditionally until a few decades ago being mostly promoted by the state, maybe more by capital independently. We both know the New York artist Joshua Citarella, who's one of the people who has been studying ideologies, which E with an ABCDE, at the beginning, which are these kind of very weird online-only sets of beliefs, which might be fleeting, might be fashion. You know, they're like kind of mini punk movements essentially. But you make an attempt at trying to redefine the role of social media and spreading and maintaining, but more importantly, producing ideologies. What is it that Mark Zuckerberg wants us to believe in as an ideology? How does that square with what Zizek tells us about ideology, mm-hmm. and how does it square with the state? What's the role here?
If we study the language of Mark Zuckerberg, which I think is important, and we need to do that because he's an unprecedented, influential person that, you know, defines the lives and modes of communication from nearly 3 billion people on this planet, which is, who can say that? In his term, there's a strange mix of, let's say, a Thatcherite kind of emphasis on the individual or on the small entities around it, like family, friends, and so on, right? Really a kind of almost a naive idea of a harmonious life in which we just have encounters and exchanges with friends and family, right? This is the core belief.
Like a pre-internet society, essentially.
Oh, yeah. this is what Mark Zuckerberg claims that he is digitizing and then facilitating on his platform. But he always mentions something else on top of that, and that's this very Catholic notion of the community. In almost every speech, he comes back to that because he believes even that these close to 3 billion users in themselves are a community, and he talks to them directly as the Facebook community, right? And there's very few people who can do that. And, you know, his close competitor really is the Pope, who has a little bit less of a following. But
that's a comparison. I'm kudos for that. I've never conceptualized it.
No, but that's very serious. But just in terms of also the way both of them can address their constituency as a whole, as something that and there we need to let's say look a bit further into this notion of the community. You know, and of course, he would be the first to say, okay, there's not one, okay, we have, there are many communities, and so on, so on, right? But that is not the interesting bit of it. What is the interesting bit there is this idea of the community that is slightly looking into itself, right? And so it has a dynamic in itself, it has values, and it has a certain unity, and it's kept together, in this case, I would say, by software and by interfaces and, in a whole ecosystem, probably also of cables, undersea cables, data centers, and so on, right? So there's a certain technological unit there. And Mark Zuckerberg really tries to emphasize that the positivity of this, right? That in the end, it is all about, the good intentions and the wellness of people and the prosperity for us all.
I think we're in an incredibly interesting moment because we've got to the point where the social networks, and in fact, a lot of the political and economic factions that are global, come with very distinct figureheads behind them. So, we mentioned the Pope, and of course, we know what the doctrine there is. Daddy Elon, now getting behind Twitter, really makes it incredibly clear what a billionaire might want to do with a social network. And granted, let's pass by all the stuff that he wanted to change his mind and frankly doesn't appear to know what he's doing, even though that is irrelevant. Whether he knows what he's doing doesn't really matter. But he makes it quite clear that he aligns himself with a ideology of long-termism, which are sort of insulting to anyone who might be paying him $8 a month, given that they're essentially being told that we're being told we don't matter for now. What matters is that only the best of us, his friends, will survive. And these are things that might be frightening to an extent. And this is what maybe the exodus from Twitter was trying to react to. But what I think is more important is that we end up contending with the real importance of these ideologies. The fact that Elon has dropped the ball and told us out loud, it's only an indictment of our stupidity, because he's been telling us, they've been telling us all of this for a long, long time. Don't mean to sound conspiratorial when we're in at the realm of complete openness, when it is that we're being told almost in the terms and terms of service, what are we signing up for?
Yeah, I really like it that you come back to this idea of ideology or ideology, for that matter, which I think is a term that is a bit more specific, focused on, let's say, subcultures, and but still very very strong, and I would say reflects also what is really going on, especially in the world of young people, which might sound like you like young people. No, I don't. This is not a question of liking of taste. Yeah. Come on, we also
they're going to be in charge. But yeah, so we'd better figure out what we have to say to them.
If you ever looked at demographics, think of Africa. The vast majority of the people on this planet are young people. Yeah. Come on. Yeah. So this is not some kind of romantic notion. Not only will they be the drivers, if you're thinking in terms of sci-fi or cli-fi, climate fiction or something like that, where you kind of extrapolate and then they help you a little bit to get a better understanding of what disasters are ahead. No, it's not just about that. It's also the factual reality. And these ideologies are lived. And this is what, from Althusser to Zizek, etc., we all It's not just a fixed idea in your head or something like a nice story, a fairy tale. No, ideology is lived. It's embodied. It's not just only embodied in your phone, but also literally in your body, right? And a lot of people, especially when we're talking about the mental states that we study, when we're talking about exhaustion, boredom, melancholy, anxiety, all the elements, right? These are mental states, techno-mental states, in my point of view, that immediately have bodily, not just the repercussions, but are inscribed in the body, in the brain, in the nerve system, in the postures, in all aspects of what we could call, the human body and how it operates, and of course how we understand today in 2022 how the body operates, of course, which is different from even 20 years ago, 50 years ago, or so we even see in neuroscience and so on, right? We see enormous progress also in a deeper understanding. And my prediction is, for instance, that we will very soon again go back to a classic of psychoanalysis, in terms of dream analysis, in terms of exploiting or get a better understanding of the way we dream. And so this is another kind of frontier for these companies, right? So there's a lot of new frontiers that still can be explored and exploited. I'm just saying, right? The stuff we
do. I have a question to this, which is actually sort of broke my mind, which is, what will sadness look like in the metaverse? So, when we actually have gone to the point where the disembodiment that Zuckerberg is proposing for us has been achieved, what is left of our emotions? And I'm quite heartened to hear you mention psychoanalysis as a tool, because that's something that, if we have any hope for academia, that there should be some pushback to a certain extent. It's not like Silicon Valley has to reinvent the understanding of the human brain and the subconscious. It will no doubt be very good at exploiting it, more so than the therapeutic and academic spheres, but at least the foundations are there. But how would you speculate about that aspect of the future?
Let's go back to Zizek again.
Yeah. Let's do a bit of depressing, and then we end on something positive, maybe.
I see. Well, the sadness in the metaverse for me has got to do with this tendency that is always there, what Robert Faller and then also Slavoj Žižek calls the tendency towards interpassivity. Mm. And so interpassivity is obviously a mirror concept to interactivity, right? We're always invited to interact and so on and so on. And what I think is so nice about the metaverse is that you can explore it. You can move around in your avatar, but because it is at least presumed to be an endless 3D environment, it has a little bit more the element in it of exploration and also of enjoyment and just seeing what's going on, right? So in that sense, I consider a good metaverse like a European or American 19th century street where a lot of stuff is happening, right? That we now miss, right? And so there is a liveliness, but also an element in the sense of interpassivity, in the sense of that we can, let's say, take part again in the social. And it's not just only about this strong pressure on the self to kind of express its self representation, its online self, and so on, right? So what I would say is the promise of the metaverse is that we can get rid of the self.
That's a big claim. I wonder if it's going to come up in Meta's marketing copy. They have, just like Twitter, got rid of about a tenth of the workforce.
I doubt, because for them, it is in the end about creating just another 3D version of the online profile, which always
that's
needed.
The cheap way. That's,
yeah,
that's cheap
but way. I think there is still the promise of the avatar that kind of supersedes this, and also what I call, the online crowd, or the tribe, or even the online mob for that matter, that has a very different aim, and the metaverse, can also lead to very new forms of crowd and mob behavior that Mark Zuckerberg for sure has not yet anticipated, right?
I think that question of the fact that the future of these technologies isn't fixed is very important to keep in mind. So we've already covered our responsibility for what we already know about legacy technologies being still spread around the particularly the global south. But the critic Dean Kissick has written quite interestingly about the kind of conceptual void of the metaverse, and I explored this in some of my writing as well. So he made this case for artists, even though I never think that artists are a good solution to any politics, but he, I think, quite astutely pointed out that Zuckerberg has no idea what the metaverse is for and what it will do. And that's not a critique of him. That's just where we are. He can still end up winning this particular game. But Kissick made the argument that actually what Zuckerberg needs is artists to come and go and do experiments. In fact, what you should be doing now is to give all these American teenagers who are at the moment shitposting on Discord, give them goggles and make them, go and make the metaverse, and we'll pay your art school fees or whatever the equivalent is. So that means that there is some responsibility for a particular creative class, in a certain sense, to go and try to rescue the technology. Now, it wouldn't be the first time this has happened. And in fact, I was telling you earlier, the reason I remembered your name and I thought it would be good to talk to you is that I read an essay of yours in which you made it quite clear that you don't think the museum, and therefore the art world, is the space in which the revolution is going to come. Hard agree. So my question, if we are to be like artificially or superficially positive, where do the influences come from that can still shape platforms, because that's the paradigm we're in a sense that is not foreclosed? You mentioned earlier alternative forms of software, open source kind of stuff, which has a long legacy. We already mentioned Mastodon, but what are the kind of bigger alternatives? Who's going to save us?
I would say not safe.
I am of course being facetious here.
Because I have to give an inaugural speech next week, and that's about the extinction internet. So I don't think it's about savior so much, but I do believe that there are new forms of the social possible, and this is how I also read, Dean's invitation, and I agree with that, right? So the experimentation there should not just be about some new form of self-representation in that space. Right?
Which is bizarrely what the art world is obsessed with at the moment,
exactly.
To its peril.
But, yes. Yeah. So we should offer, the Lonely Hearts Club Band that is out there to precisely overcome that trap, that tendency, in which I think the art world also ran into in the case of Instagram. But to understand this moment as a moment to reshape the social in unheard ways, right? And I'm not saying it should be a tribe. I'm not saying please don't go back to the community. Don't even think also, of course, in my terms, that it should necessarily be a network. I believe that maybe it's going to be something more, probably more evil, or something more primal. Than that, and so the idea, of salvation should really be skipped, But nonetheless, new forms of experience of the social is something, of course, that the gaming world has announced for many years, if not decades. And I see this world more as a predecessor of what we've known in the world of gaming, and not so much as a reference to the social media, which I think were in the end hopelessly still too based on kind of an old understanding of advertisement, and we know that from the crypto world, you know, an old understanding also of monetization, of value creation, and of a new form of the social, which is also called the commons. Mm-hmm. There are new forms of the commons possible. The current leading Silicon Valley companies have very, very little, if no idea.
Are you talking about initiatives like Web 3.0 kind of conglomeration?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. I mean, that's an exponent.
Definitely, and I'm absolutely in favor of that. But it should not just be about, you know, individual gains or speculative moves where, you know, you're happy if the Bitcoin goes up a few hundred dollars. That is not what it is about.
That's playing against yourself, really, in the end. I'm kind of happy that you've taken us back down. Of course, facetiously used the word salvation, and unfortunately, I am a classic doomer. The last question to do with that, I wanted to ask you about something that plagues me and what I'm going to be at the conference you're hosting tomorrow trying to talk about, which is the question of why certain network effects favor the political right and have very little space for the political left. Particularly, I'm interested in notions of embodiment, which you favored, I think, or at least you advocated taking very seriously, and questions of community. So here, unlike in the embodiment questions, I have enough evidence from this kind of post-liberal, post-left space that I hang out in to know that there is a movement back towards a community, your traditional community. And bizarrely, people who started off online on the Substack with kind of weird followings, you know, Curtis Yarvin and so those kind of characters, who are in some senses really Silicon Valley thinkers and also exponents of this kind of hyper ideologies, you know, where you really put together the most ridiculous two words and suddenly there's a whole belief system. They are successful on the back of platforms, and they somehow manage to use them to bring back, without so much fuss, come back to the old-fashioned 1970s question of the community, like pre-Reaganite, pre-Thatcher idea of a community. Is that what's missing for the left? Why is it not working out for the two politics equally?
You know, the classic tools of organization no longer work, right? So what the left still hasn't really left behind is its preoccupation with the political party and the trade union. Mm. And this is a critique of the 1970s, and nothing has happened with that since, right? Of course, I come from a generation who, naively or not, expressed the idea that, you know, the social movements somehow could be an alternative, or local communities, for that matter, as a kind of a more crystallization, manifestation of the larger social movement. So in our understanding, you know, the movements would always be grounded in the localities. But that has not resolved the question of organization. Mm. And I think where the left at the moment still fails to do it is to openly admit that the current forms of organizations, and then also related to that, of course, representation, and then ultimately decision making, these things no longer work, and that people no longer recognize themselves in these institutional farce that is out there, which is a relic of the past. So my call would be to experiment with new forms of organizations, and together with Ned Rositer, I've come up with one very very small kind of contribution there. We kind of played with the idea of organized networks, like smaller units, but that still try to maintain a kind of a core belief in the idea of networks, and that some of these networks, for instance, can have translocal elements, right? Which is what the experiments we do here in our Institute of Network Cultures at the moment with hybrid events, right? Where we kind of envision that you and I, we are in the room here, but maybe, you know, here at these two chairs, there are people sitting here who are not here, but join us, right? And this kind of idea that others can be equally present, right? It's still a novel idea, and it's something that I think the coming generations will really start to experiment with. Hmm? So it's not just a romantic idea of going back to the countryside or going back to offline, going back to the real neighborhoods, you know, that no longer exist, right? No, but we should instead experiment with the new forms of the social. That is a techno-social, of course, but obviously not, you know, techno-determinist.
Yeah, I wish I could find this as inspiring as kind of happy-making as you might be making. Because as you were saying, I was thinking both about Mastodon, which is, of course, in the news, but then in my ear, this constant ringing about this platform called Urbit that you might have come across, which is, I came to understand only after someone talked to me about it for 3 hours, that it was actually the invention of Curtis Yarvin, who I'm very sure is not interested in the same kind of politics that you are trying to underpin here. I'm skeptical of the fact that the machine is predetermined to be evil. This is one of the small bits that I kind of took issue with some of the argument in your book. But then historically, unfortunately, evidence is on your side rather than mine. Maybe we should leave this on this depressing note. Because there's all, but thank you. There's all to play for, I think. If I'm rendered happy by the end of our conference, I shall record an addendum to our conversation. Thank you very much, Kurt.
Thank you.
Set by Design by Hert Loving is published by Pluto Press. I'm Pierre Lorenzo, and the editor is Marshall Poe. Thanks for listening, and join us next time.